From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish. I am so stressed out. How often do you hear that from a friend, from a partner, from a coworker? How often do you say it yourself? I'm stressed out. Well, consider this. Before the year 1976, the New York Times had never published an article about stress, at least stress as we understand it today. The changing definitions of stress are one focus of a new book by Dana Becker. It's called One Nation Under Stress, The Trouble with Stress as an Idea. Becker is a professor of social work at Bryn Mawr, and she joins us now. Dana Becker, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Audie.
So you're arguing that we need to essentially rethink how we understand stress. And I want to start with some of the history that you write about, because it sounds like our current view of stress is pretty recent. I mean, how was stress thought of earlier than the 20th century?
Well, really, if we think back to the middle of the 19th century, George Beard, who coined the term neurasthenia, was really the first in this country to talk about American nervousness, really. Of course, he didn't call it stress then. But the idea was that a lot of physicians were finding that they had middle-class patients who seemed to be falling by the wayside with all of these things they were calling nervous disease at the time. And Beard felt that it was really the fast pace of American life that had really caused people to feel nervous in this way.
And when he lists American stressors, he points to steam power, the mental activity of women, the cruelly competitive marketplace, the pressures of urban life, the climate of the Northeast. I mean, all of these things you could hear today, whether you said internet, media, Facebook, mommy wars. But is there a cultural shift there in terms of thinking that it's a personal and internal thing that needs to be taken care of?
Well, I think that he and folks who came after him had the idea that stress was what was outside, you know, that the conditions were more important to talk about. And then we could certainly talk about the illness. And now it seems that we've shifted, really brought that outside in. So we become preoccupied with risks to our health and our mental health, our psyches, and we lose sight of the conditions that really create the stress in the first place.
So is stress essentially culturally defined? You know, essentially we're saying we've kind of created it as a concept.
Yes, definitely. It's definitely an idea. It's not a thing out there. It's an idea, and it's an idea that has a certain currency, and it shapes really the way we talk, the way we think about ourselves, and the way we think about our relationship to the world, really.
Now, there's going to be a lot of people hearing this in their car with furrowed brows saying, I definitely feel stress. Stress is real. So help us understand what you mean.
Well, I certainly can feel it at the moment. You know, I'm doing this interview and, hey, I'm a little nervous about it. I could say I'm stressed out. I'm certainly not saying, because people do ask me, you know, are you saying there's no such thing as the experience of stress? And I'm saying, no, no. We do experience something we are calling stress.
And you argue that at this point there's a kind of stress inflation. What does that mean?
Well, I think, you know, having read a lot of what the media's had to say about stress, it feels like we're using the term to cover just about everything from a hangnail to the war on terror. But the way that we react to stress also affects the way we are in the world, the way we act, the kinds of options that we have for how to behave. But I don't think anybody's really to blame. It's really about an idea that's taken hold and it has its cultural moment.
But give us an example of what you mean by that when you say that kind of the way the idea takes hold of us.
Well, for instance, let me give the example that I talk about quite a bit in the book. This idea that working mothers are under tremendous stress today, right? There's a huge number of articles about working women's stress and a lot of advice on what we should do. You know, we should eat more kale, we should do yoga, we should exercise, we should make more to-do lists. And it's a primarily middle-class kind of solution, are these solutions to what we see as the, quote, stress problem today. But unfortunately, that draws us into thinking more about how stress is going to affect, for instance, our health or our psychological health than it does to think about, say, the fact that family medical leave is still unpaid, that the school day is shorter than the work day is, that we still are a society that essentially devalues caregiving, that workplace policies haven't kept pace with dual career families.
But Dana, I mean, it's much easier for me to eat kale than to take on my school system's, you know, the length of the day. I mean, what's wrong with making the reduction of stress a personal pursuit, something you one person actually feels they can take some control of?
Well, I think it's fine. I actually don't think there's a problem. I think it's a both and, right? You know, we've become so preoccupied with our health and the risks there are to our health that I just fear that it rather obscures sometimes what we might be looking at as the social conditions that create the stress. And it can sap us of our energy to do that. I'm not suggesting it's not a good thing for us to take care of ourselves. It certainly is that. And I think that you point out something, Audie, that's really useful to consider, especially now in a world where uncertainty is really king or queen, you know, that we want to control what we can control. And it's difficult for people to think in these large terms, in these social terms. But I guess my argument is that we need to do both and that we want to understand the part that this whole discourse about stress and this whole idea of stress plays in the way we've come to think about our problems.
Dana Becker, she's the author of the new book, One Nation Under Stress, The Trouble with Stress as an Idea. Dana, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Audie.
Sheryl Sandberg has been the subject of op-eds and cranky commentaries in the past few weeks over a book that wasn't even out until today. As chief operating officer of Facebook and before that a top executive at Google, Sheryl Sandberg has not been known to court controversy. But her new book is something of a feminist call to arms, and it struck a chord. Here's a woman with two Harvard degrees who's reached the top of the tech industry, and she's calling on other women to, as she puts it, lean in and embrace success.
Welcome to Facebook.
We met up with Sandberg at Facebook's headquarters in Silicon Valley.
So everyone works like this. We're all in these very big open spaces. You'll see no one has any cubicles, offices. There are no dividers between people, so teams can collaborate and talk together.
As we walk around, Sandberg points to posters on the wall, posters that spell out the Facebook creed with slogans like, move fast and break things.
My favorite says, what would you do if you weren't afraid? Something that I think is really important and I think very motivating.
Well, what would you do if you weren't afraid? Are you not afraid? Come on.
Well, I wrote,
you don't
I
seem
wrote,
very afraid.
I wrote in my book, what I would do if I wasn't afraid is I would speak out more on behalf of women.
Preparing to speak to us about the book called Lean In, Sheryl Sandberg got comfortable, crossing her legs beneath her on a big orange chair, and I asked her, tell us how you reacted when one might think the most amazingly wonderful thing happened to you, which is you were named by Forbes magazine back in 2011, one of the five most powerful women in the world.
So Forbes puts out this list every year of the most powerful women in the world, and they put me as number five on the list. And, you know, I thought it was absurd. My mother even called to say, well, dear, I do think you're very powerful, but I'm not sure you're more powerful than, you know, Michelle Obama. And I'm thinking, of course I'm not more powerful than Michelle Obama.
Who wasn't one of those five.
I think she was right up there, but yes, not one of those five. And the thing that's important about the story is I was really embarrassed. People would congratulate me in the halls at Facebook, and I would literally tell them why it was silly. People would post it on Facebook, and I would call them and ask them to, you know, can you take that off? I really don't feel comfortable. My assistant pulled me into my conference room and closed the door. And she said, you're handling this really badly. Stop telling everyone who says congratulations how silly that list is because you look insecure. You're showing everyone how uncomfortable you are with your own power, and that's not good. So just start saying thank you.
Well, there are two lines of argument throughout this book, and one of them has to do with changing society. The other has to do with women addressing aspects of themselves. And you have a plethora of studies in this book, and some of them suggest how women view themselves. Give us one example.
We call our little girls bossy. Go to a playground. Little girls get called bossy all the time, a word that's almost never used for boys. And that leads directly to the problems women face in the workforce. When a man does a good job, everyone says that's great. When a woman does that same thing, she'll get feedback that says things like, your results are good, but your peers just don't like you as much, or maybe you were a little aggressive.
Now, there's a study. You're not just saying that. You're not just saying that as an anecdote.
No, I mean, the data shows very clearly that one thing above all, which is that success and likability are positively correlated for men and negatively correlated for women. That means that as a man gets more successful, he is better liked by men and women. And as a woman gets more successful, she is less liked by men and women. But I want to be clear, I am not saying that men are too self-confident. That's not the problem. The problem is that women aren't self-confident enough.
Give us a couple of key statistics as to how women in 2013 have still really, and not in great numbers, made it to the top.
Yeah. The blunt truth is we've ceased making progress at the top in any industry anywhere in the world. In the United States, women have had 14% of the top corporate jobs and 17% of the board seats for 10 years. 10 years of no progress. In those same 10 years, women are getting more and more of the graduate degrees, more and more of the undergraduate degrees. And it's translating into more women in entry-level jobs, even more women in lower-level management. But there's absolutely been no progress at the top. You can't explain away 10 years. 10 years of no progress is no progress.
Let me ask you about your own industry. And here's a statistic for you. Less than 18% of computer science majors are women. How do you get more girls and women into computer science so that they can climb the ladder, or what you might call the jungle gym, in one of the few really successful sectors in this country?
It's such a great question, because what's holding women back in computer science is the exact same thing I write about in my book that's holding women back in leadership, which is what social scientists call stereotype threat. Stereotype threat means that the more we're aware of a stereotype, the more we act in accordance with it. So stereotypically, we believe girls are not good at math. Therefore, girls don't do well at math, and it self-perpetuates. If you ask a girl right before she takes a math test to check off M or F for male or female, she does worse on that test.
Given that you've made this meteoric rise in two companies that also shot to the top in very short periods of time, you've had powerful mentors. The one that people will probably know was former Secretary of Treasury Larry Summers, also former president of Harvard. Have you ever thought that in a way you were chosen as there's only room for one or two, and in some sense gifted to pass on through and be one of the few women who get there?
It used to be the case that exactly as you're saying, there was only room for one or two. And women would look at each other in a room and know that because they were tokens, there only one of them was getting promoted. There was only room for one of them at that table. And they were competitive with each other, or at least that's what I've been told. Now, I think that's different. Every company I know is looking for more women at the table. Every board is looking for more women at the table. There's a reason why men want to understand the challenges women face, address them, because then they're going to be better hirers, attractors, and retainers of women. Warren Buffett has very generously said that one of the reasons he was so successful is he was only competing with half the population. Companies that use the full talents of everyone, those companies do better.
You speak from a position of person who you've earned it, but who at this point in time is can do pretty much anything you want. Well off, you're not tethered to all kinds of duties at home, and you are running things. Is it realistic to ask or suggest that other women can in some way follow in your path?
Yeah, I don't hold myself out as a role model. I don't believe that everyone should make the same choices, that everyone has to want to be a CEO or everyone should want to be a work-at-home mother. I want everyone to be able to choose. But I want us to be able to choose unencumbered by gender choosing for us. I have a 7-year-old son and a 5-year-old daughter. Success for me is that if my son chooses to be a stay-at-home parent, he is cheered on for that decision. And if my daughter chooses to work outside the home and is successful, she's cheered on and supported.
Sheryl Sandberg, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you for coming to Facebook. We're glad to have you.
Sheryl Sandberg is COO of Facebook. Her new book out today is Lean In, Women Work and the Will to Lead.
It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon.
There are some who can live without wild things and some who cannot. These essays are the delights and dilemmas of one who cannot.
These are the opening pages of a Sand County Almanac, a collection of essays and observations written decades ago by the father of the American conservation movement, Aldo Leopold.
Like winds and sunsets, wild things were taken for granted until progress began to do away with them. Now we face the question whether a still higher, quote, standard of living is worth its cost in things natural, wild, and free.
The original was published in 1949, a year after Leopold's death. But his groundbreaking writings on conservation and ecology become more relevant with each passing year. This month, the Library of America will publish a special edition of A Sand County Almanac and inspire yet another generation of conservationists. As a teenager, Stan Temple was captivated by Leopold's writing. Now, Temple is professor emeritus in conservation at the University of Wisconsin.
It's like he was so far ahead of his contemporaries that the things he was writing about just before his death really didn't find an audience until 25 years later.
Leopold pioneered the science of ecology using only binoculars and a notebook. He invented wildlife management, and his work is still on the cutting edge of the field even 64 years later. Leopold didn't live to hear the phrase climate change, but his journals are now used by researchers like Temple to gain insight on global warming.
We could use these historical records to put 2012 into context.
Temple realized that by comparing Leopold's observations of springtime in the 1940s to springtime in 2012, researchers could show the speed of climate change.
Flowers had never bloomed so early in Aldo Leopold's data and in Henry David Thoreau's data and indeed in all the subsequent data.
Leopold kept meticulous journals. He'd sit outside on his hand-built bench on his land in southwestern Wisconsin and write about what he saw. Here's one such passage.
The skunk track enters the woods and crosses a glade where the rabbits have packed down the snow. Newly exposed oak seedlings have paid for the thaw with their newly barked stems.
His writings are extremely detailed. What you're listening to now is a recreation Temple made of Leopold's morning soundtrack just by following his journal descriptions, bird by bird.
Leopold is revered for the way he wrote about this place, this wonderful lyrical prose that evokes the dramas that are going on in this landscape that he knew so intimately.
Kurt Miney is Aldo Leopold's biographer. Leopold's words are as relevant as if he'd written them yesterday. Yet he was writing for his own lifetime, which spanned the extinction of the passenger pigeon and the nuclear bombing of Japan.
It was a time of incredible change in the entire landscape. The great forests of the upper Great Lakes were being leveled. The wetlands of the Mississippi River Basin were being drained. Waterfowl and other wildlife were being depleted. The prairies of the Midwest, of course, were being converted over into agriculture.
In Leopold's youth, Teddy Roosevelt was president, and environmental preservation was a national discussion for the first time. Leopold's father taught him how to hunt and respect the land, and later, Aldo Leopold would graduate from the Yale School of Forestry and join the Forest Service as a ranger. And on that job, in the mountains of southeastern Arizona, Leopold had an experience that shaped his thinking for the next 30 years. Again, biographer Kurt Miney.
One of the most significant episodes occurs right at the outset of his career when he shoots a wolf.
Leopold wrote about this in one of his most famous essays.
We reach the old wolf in time to watch a fierce green fire dying in her eyes. I realized then and have known ever since that there was something new to me in those eyes, something known only to her and to the mountain.
Killing the wolf triggered Leopold's introspective mind. He realized that preserving land wasn't enough. We had to work to actively protect it. In the 1930s, Leopold witnessed the destruction of agriculture and overdevelopment. The Dust Bowl devastated the land and deepened the Great Depression. He turned his thoughts now to the idea of restoration. So the Leopold family bought a piece of ravaged land in Baraboo, Wisconsin, and set about rejuvenating it. Kurt Miney and Stan Temple took me out on the Leopold land on a snowy, sub-zero day to see the landscape from Leopold's old cabin.
We're coming up to the shack.
But let's pause for a moment, because what you see, anything that's living here, any plants living, were not here in Leopold's day, pretty much. So we just walked through a little woods, a mixture of pines and oaks. All the pines you see were planted. But right out in front of us here is one of the earliest experiments in ecological restoration we have.
Leopold's experiment started by planting his beloved pine trees, 50,000 over his lifetime. Every spring, he'd drag the family to this little shack, and they'd plant trees and write journals to record the evolution of the land.
Locke is frozen. There we go.
And here, inside this tiny bare-bone shack, a converted chicken coop, Leopold wrote his land ethic. The essay argues for responsible, ethical treatment of nature, which became the core of modern conservation.
In short, a land ethic changes the role of Homo sapiens from conqueror of the land community to plain member and citizen of it. It implies respect for his fellow members and also respect for the community as such.
If Aldo Leopold could participate today in the public debate over hydrofracking, mountaintop removal, and carbon emissions, he would say that these challenges are what the land ethic is for. It's inconceivable to me, he wrote, that an ethical relationship to the land can exist without love, respect, and admiration, and a high regard for its value. Stay with us a little later in the show, the revival of the off-Broadway musical, The Last 5 Years. It's NPR News.
Susan Spencer Wendell sure knows how to spend a year. She left her job as an award-winning criminal courts reporter for the Palm Beach Post and then went to the Yukon to see the Northern Lights. She went to Cyprus to meet family she never knew. She and her husband John took their children on trips in which her daughter got to try on wedding dresses, and Susan got kissed by a dolphin. She also got a new dog, put a splendid hut in her backyard, and she wrote a book. It's a memoir about the year she says she wanted to devote to joy before she's claimed by ALS, a neuromuscular disorder often known as Lou Gehrig's disease. A few months ago, we spoke with Susan Spencer Wendell from the studios of WPBI in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and because muscle damage caused by ALS affects speech, she was joined by her husband, John. And Susan told us how she felt after being diagnosed with ALS in 2011 at the age of 44.
Equally grateful.
For a life of perfect health.
For a life of perfect health.
And determined to face it.
And determined to face it.
With bravery.
With bravery.
She's also faced her terminal illness with a great sense of humor. As for how she shared the news of her illness with her children.
Very carefully.
Very carefully.
Don't overwhelm them with bad news.
Don't overwhelm them with bad news.
Just a little bit at a time.
Just a little bit at a time.
My Year of Living with Joy, which she wrote with Brett Witter and a little help from technology. You wrote this book on your iPhone.
I did. 89,000 words.
89,000 words, all on the iPhone.
I only have use of my right thumb.
She only has use of her right thumb, and that's the only way she could type.
Would you like us to read?
Would you like us to read an excerpt of how she did that?
Please.
By June, I had lost the ability to use my iPad. The keyboard was too big, and it tired my right hand to move it back and forth. I decided to write the book using the notes function on my iPhone instead. John would slide the phone into my useless left hand, where, by serendipity, my curled fingers formed a perfect holder. I would type each letter with my right thumb, tap, tap, the only digit I could use. When I typed the last letter of the first draft in mid-September, 3 months after beginning in earnest, I couldn't believe what I'd accomplished. I felt as if I'd pulled myself up a mountain with 9 fingers tied behind my back. I let the moment linger, the thrill of a triathlon completed. I looked at John, who was sitting across from me in the cheeky hut. I expected to smile, to beam, with the dream fulfilled. I cried, and formed the words as best I could. What will I do now?
Susan, help us understand why you wrote the book. For your children, but also you've always been a writer.
First and foremost, I wrote the book for
I wrote the book for my family and friends to have, to jog their memories after I'm gone.
And what I also realized as a storyteller.
I also realized that as a storyteller, it's an amazing tale of twinning good and bad fortune. Themes that touch everyday people, friendship, devotion, and discovery.
Let me ask you about some of these trips. You went to the Yukon to see the Northern Lights with your best friend, Nancy.
Yes.
But the lights were off.
As you know, life ain't perfect.
As you know, life ain't perfect.
The lights did not show.
The lights did not show. They still had a wonderful time there.
John, may I ask you a question?
Of course.
What's this period been like for you?
Well, difficult. Every day I wake up, I feel sad. That's my first emotion. And then I roll over and I look at Susan and I realize that she's not allowing herself to feel that way, so I can't. And I don't.
Susan, how are you doing?
I have very, very down moments.
She can have down moments.
But generally, I'm doing pretty darn well.
Generally, doing pretty darn well.
This book is so funny.
I know that, too.
Glad to hear you say that.
I really don't want people to think.
She doesn't want people to think it's a maudlin book.
If you say it's funny, not, then we've made it home.
If you think it's funny, then we've made it home.
Well, Susan Spencer Wendell and her husband John Wendell in Fort Lauderdale. She tells the story of a year in her life with ALS in the new book, Until I Say Goodbye. Thank you so much.
Our pleasure.
We checked in with Susan this week, asked how she's doing. She wrote, "My pat answer is, as well as can be expected. My body and voice become weaker every single day, but my mind becomes mightier and more quiet. You do indeed hear more in silence." You can read an excerpt from Susan Spencer Wendell's book at npr.org/books. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
You could hardly imagine a more satisfying American story than that of performer Rita Moreno. She was born in Puerto Rico and may have stayed there if her young mother hadn't decided to put the both of them on a boat bound for New York.
It was ferocious, and it took us days to get to the port in New York City. Needless to say that during the trip, everyone was getting sick, and everyone was upchucking, and the toilets were overflowing. It was pretty horrible.
After a childhood filled with struggle in the Bronx, Rita Moreno's journey to stardom took flight. From the golden age of movies, where she performed alongside Gene Kelly and Mario Lanza, to the height of her movie fame as Anita in West Side Story, and then the long years of struggle to get parts after that big hit, she's now firmly etched into Hollywood history. Moreno is just one of a handful of performers to have won all of the most prestigious show business awards. Aside from the Oscar and Golden Globe, she's also won a Tony, a couple of Emmys, and a Grammy. I spoke with Rita Moreno last week about her new memoir, and she told us where her movie career really began, in 1949, when, as a young teenager, she was invited to meet MGM studio head Louis B. Mayer at the Waldorf Astoria in New York City.
We were insanely excited. And first of all, we didn't know what a Waldorf Astoria was. So we asked around. I mean, you know, people who live in ghettos very often don't get out of them, especially at that time. We went to the hotel, and my mother goes to the counter and says to the concierge or whomever it was, "We have to see Mr. Louis B. Mayer at the penthouse." And the man said, "Well, you know, take the elevator and go up to the penthouse." So we get to the elevator, and there's no word there that says penthouse. So we leave the elevator again and go back to the lady. "See, I don't see no penthouse." And she said, "Oh, yes, of course. It's P-H.
How are you supposed to know the code?"
Exactly. So we went back into the elevator, and sure enough, we hit the buttons P-H, and the elevator doors opened up into the suite. And I was trying very, very hard at that time to look like my idol because I had no role models. My idol at the time was Elizabeth Taylor. So I had on the waist cincher, and we boosted my bosom a little bit, and I had the hair just right, the eyebrows, because my eyebrows were a lot thicker then. And interestingly enough, within minutes, he looked at me and he said, "Well, she looks like a Spanish Elizabeth Taylor." And that was the beginning of my new life and my involvement with Enchantment.
You got to work with some amazingly big names at the time. You tell an amazing story in the book about filming Singing in the Rain and that kind of seminal scene that we think of Gene Kelly dancing in the rain. Can you recount that?
He had 103 fever when he was doing that. He was sick as a dog. And the worst part of this is that the set was really outside. It was a big, huge black tent. And I can't imagine how he didn't end up, really, with pneumonia. But I have to tell you that I visited the set every single day. I did maybe a week and a half's worth of work in that show. But I visited all the sets every single day. Well, I didn't have that much to do. So I would get all dressed up every morning and go to the studio, go through those famous gates where Jack Nicholson once told me he used to wait for me. He didn't know who I was, but he said, "You were so sexy. You used to wear these very..."
He probably said it just like that, too.
Yeah. Oh, well, you know, with that leer of his. And he said, "You wore these very tight white dresses and you were always very tanned. And I would wait for you." And he said, "You'd give me heart attacks." I kind of liked hearing that.
So you got roles, but you ended up getting a lot of roles that you describe as kind of general ethnic.
That's it. I became the house ethnic. And that meant that I had to play anything that was not American. So I became this gypsy girl, or I was a Polynesian girl, or I was an Egyptian girl. And finally, I decided that by playing all of these roles, I should have some kind of accent. But of course, I had no idea what these people sounded like, so I made up my own, and I now call it the universal ethnic accent. The funny part of it is that all my ethnic characters that I played all sounded exactly the same.
"Is not homesickness that make me sad, Mrs. Anna. His love for one I shall never see again."
"Oh, poor child."
"He is Lunta, who was chosen to bring me here."
For a while, that was wonderful. I was in the movies. But then I began to understand that it was really very demeaning. And I began to feel more and more and more diminished. I was already very unsure of myself anyway, because when I was a very young girl in New York City, I ran into an awful lot of racial bias. And I got called some pretty nasty names, you know, like spick, and all the words that you heard in West Side Story came directly from the streets: garlic mouth, pierced ear. So by the time I was doing those kind of roles, I was beginning to feel pretty bad about myself.
The role that many people remember you for,
is the role of Anita in West Side Story.
Of course.
Will you let me miss?
She's too dark to pass.
Oh, don't.
Please don't.
Por favor. No comprende?
Gracias.
De nada.
Ay, hey, Michael.
Listen, you.
We're listening.
You write that when you were doing some of those scenes, that it did feel incredibly real to you.
Oh, it did. Well, you know, the acting part, without trying to sound like I'm showing off, was just with my eyes closed. I knew this girl. That was part of my life, part of my experience. I didn't have to say to myself, well, let's see, what's the motivation here? Are you kidding? I know the motivation. You know, I've been Anita, except I wasn't a gang member, of course. That was the easiest part of the auditions. The dancing was absolutely frightening because I hadn't danced in about 10, 12 years at the time. So I loved doing it. I was thrilled to get the part. And I worked my booty off.
You went on to be nominated for and to win the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress.
That's right. Unbelievable. I just couldn't believe that that was happening to me.
Do you remember the moment when they called your name?
Do I remember the moment? Does a bear poop in the woods? Notice how I censored myself.
I did,
so nicely.
Yeah, the restraint was
so gracefully. I did this memorable non-speech. I said, I don't believe it. And there's this pause, and then I say, good Lord. And then I'm trying to think of something, and I finally say, I leave you with that. And I ran
and
into
then
the
you walked off.
No, I ran into the wings. I started to cry.
When did you realize that this was actually not just about you, that your win had reverberated through a larger community?
You know, that took quite some time. It's so interesting. Latinos at that time just culturally did not have a reason to write fan letters in America. They may have done it in Mexico and Puerto Rico and whatever, but they didn't do that in America. So I had very little contact with the Hispanic community. I had no idea. And then one day, many years later, Liz Torres, that wonderful comedian, told me this story. She was living in Harlem at the time, Spanish Harlem, and it was a very hot night, Oscar night, and all the windows were open. And she said, and you know what the ghetto is like. It's noisy. People are yelling at each other. People are dropping bottles down the windows into the yard. And it's just a very noisy place. Music is playing. She said, but that night the Oscars were on. And she said that when Rock Hudson began to announce the names of the nominees for Best Featured Actress, she said the place went dead quiet. And she said, when my name was announced, the place went up in smoke. They were screaming and yelling and hugging and jumping up and down and yelling out the windows, she did it, she did it, in Spanish and in English. And, you know, a friend of mine said to me, you know what they were really saying? We did it. We did it. And I tell you, when she told me that story the first time, I just started to cry because it really put me back in touch with my people. And I had a people. I had a people who knew all about me. I just didn't know about them.
Rita Moreno, she joined us from our bureau in New York. Her memoir, self-titled, is out now. Ms. Moreno, thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. It was great fun talking to you.
I like to be in America. Okay, by me in America. Everything free in America.
For a small fee in America.
Okay. Buying on credit is so nice.
One look at us and they charge twice.
I have my own washing machine.
What will you have, though, to keep clean?
Skyscrapers bloom in America. Cadillac bloom in America. Industry boom in America.
12 in a room in America.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.